You're with Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to TNT, today's News Talk. I'm Patrick Henningsen. What an amazing, amazing segment with French journalist Freddie Ponton just before the break, really trying to find out what's really going on there in Mariupol. And as I said when we were talking to Freddie, it just very much mirrors, in my mind anyway, I get a sense of deja vu because I've kind of seen this scene before in Aleppo. In previous years, during sort of the height of the Syrian conflict there, we're talking about 2013, 14, 15, late 2016, where some of the same sort of events were taking place as the part of Aleppo was beginning to fall from the hands of the terrorist extremist factions who were occupying it. And then all of a sudden, all sorts of emergencies started to appear. Western leaders demanding humanitarian corridors and to exfiltrate people out of the area. So we're seeing it all happen again. Thank you, Freddie Ponton, for giving us a little bit of insight there on what's happening on the French side of that story. So, but just to cast a broader net now, there's a lot of incredible things that are really transpiring now as we speak. And many weeks ago, we had our next guest on this program to sort of help to put the conflict into perspective geopolitically and politically as well. And a former British ambassador to Syria and Bahrain. He's also a global affairs analyst, and his name is Peter Ford. He's joining us right now on the live link. Hello, Peter.
Hello, Patrick. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you for joining us, Peter. And I'm hoping that you can help give us some a little bit of perspective on what we're seeing unfolding right now. We're at a kind of very strange impasse at the moment with this conflict in Ukraine. And as I commented before this introduction, Peter, and also he spoke with Freddie Ponton before in the previous segment, I'm seeing so many parallels and some of these scenes around these cities and some of the same political shenanigans, games, obfuscation, distractions, deflections, questionable reports of massacres. You've seen this all before. In other words, Peter, you've seen this rodeo play out in the past, in the very near past, in fact, with Syria. Are you noticing some of the same patterns and some of the same incidents and how these stories and narratives are being used politically and through the media? But I'll let you give us your opinion on this.
Yes, very much so. Patrick, I have a strong sense of deja vu. And we're certainly seeing leaves taken out of the Syrian playbook, but not in the way that Western leaders and medias claim. It's not Russia which is taking leaves out of its Syrian playbook, but it's rather the West and its protégés and proxies, which is behaving similarly to the way other proxies and their intelligence handlers worked in Syria. For example, the famous alleged chemical weapons attack in Douma, just outside Damascus. There was clear evidence of tampering with bodies, as well as tampering with the gas canisters, which we were supposed to believe that a gas canister had bounced up off a concrete floor conveniently onto a bed. But the Western media will believe anything, however outlandish, as long as it demonizes the Syrians or now the Russians. Our Western media have totally lost their moorings. Nobody thinks to ask, well, alleged these bodies, where actually might they have come from? How can you discount the theory, the Russian claim, that this was staged? there is just a blanket assumption that because the Ukrainians say it is so, that it must be true. But I haven't heard even an attempt to discount the Russian claims that there's been staging, that, for example, bodies could have been brought from morgues, or that bodies, victims of shelling, could, after death, have been mutilated, hands tied, all that stuff. Where's the proof that that manipulation of evidence didn't happen? The onus is on those who make accusations to prove that a crime has happened. I mean, haven't people watched enough Sherlock Holmes dramas to at least ask themselves a question, where's the real evidence?
It's not only that, in the Sherlock Holmes dramas as well, there's motive. Motive is also an important part. Is in addition to the evidence, who benefits from any particular action, Peter? And I'm looking at the Bucha massacre. This is the latest event. This one's been more or less emerged in the last 48 hours. And apparently the media is telling us there was a massacre there, and that the Russian forces, when they were leaving the town of Bucha, this is a suburb of Kiev, that they just went on a random rampage and killed all sorts of, brutally killed all sorts of Ukrainian residents for no other reason, just really looks like for sport. That's the main narrative. It was pretty much unquestionably disseminated across the entire Western media organs, and politicians are running with this. Immediately, sanctions were kicked into place on the European level. Meanwhile, Russia's saying, calm down, calm down. Look, we've got evidence here that this might not be all that it appears to be. And Ambassador Nebenzia, this is a Russian UN ambassador, Peter, he basically demanded that the UN Security Council have a meeting immediately to discuss this. And clearly, Russia had some evidentiary points they would like to put on the table that might have countered the main narrative. But the rotating presidency of the UN Security Council, as you know, is currently occupied by Britain. And Britain turned down the Russia's request for an emergency meeting. I believe this was on either Sunday evening or Monday. And according to the Russian delegation, that's unprecedented. In other words, it's never happened. They're always on call 24/7. You being a former diplomat, you're knowledgeable of some of these precedents and how things work. What do you think about this situation?
I'm not sure if the British chair of the Security Council hadn't now been forced to concede a meeting. I thought I caught on the radio just now some breaking news, but I may be mistaken. But it would not surprise me if the British government were nervous about having any kind of independent investigation or giving Russia some kind of international platform to lay out its case. But as I say, they may have had to concede that. But what I'd add is that it would be out of character for the Russians to behave in the way that's being alleged in Syria. Fighters on every side had great respect for the Russians, which is why the Russians have been so active as mediators and intermediaries. Their military police have gone into areas that were controlled by jihadis. They've not allowed Syrian government forces into some of these no-go areas, but they've been accepted by the so-called rebels. Now, if the Russians were just cutthroats, that seems rather out of character. I doubt if we will ever know the truth about what's going on right now in Ukraine. Enough sand is being thrown into our eyes, and I can't see any kind of independent mechanism ever being allowed to make a proper serious report in Ukraine. But, you know, this is all about the moment. This is all about whipping up hysteria in the Western audience to persuade Westerners that we have to continue making the economic sacrifices that we are doing. I mean, who's paying for these hundreds of millions of pounds worth of arms which are being shipped into Ukraine? I believe the British Army must be envious of the way the British government is shoveling taxpayer pounds into buying arms for the Ukrainian army rather than the under-equipped, understaffed British army. So public opinion has to be kept in a constantly hysterical state by stories of atrocity and what have you.
And what I remember from Syria, and you might be able to comment on this as well, you know, some of the binding sanctions that still are basically placed on the Syrian government. It's an embargo, effectively, what they've done economically to Syria. But it was the Hula massacre. You remember the Hula massacre? I believe this was 2013, around there.
Yeah.
And that's specifically cited, you know, by European delegations, Council of Europe, as this one of those seminal events that's used to justify whatever their policy is, foreign policy vis-a-vis Syria. And I looked at this story in Bucha, and immediately the EU reacted immediately. More sanctions. They had already begun ramping them up, and they're getting ready to ink the paper, Peter. And it seems like the same sort of thing. The Hula massacre was the narrative was discredited very thoroughly. It's very clear what happened there, and it wasn't what the official emotional story at the time was. But that emotional story fit into what the Western general themes were at the time. So therefore, it wasn't questioned. They just ran with it. And I think, how long can we keep going with this? Because how many of these sort of events can be lined up in order to whack, keep everybody in line diplomatically? Germany's wavering a little bit because of the gas issue, Peter. Hungary's completely not supporting the war at all. So there's a few breaks there in the European facade. What do you think?
Indeed, the unity of NATO is one of the lies that we're telling ourselves at the moment. And there's quite a pattern here of us telling ourselves lies. You know, we've all heard it. Putin has ended up cementing the unity of NATO. But how come when Hungary and Slovakia and one or two others are clearly not with the plot? They're not going along with the not allowing a shipment of arms across their borders. That's a pretty big reservation to hold. Others like Macron have been trying to mediate. There's a facade of unity, but you don't have to scratch far into the veneer to see that when push comes to shove, that European unity is fragile. And it comes to a head over the issue of gas. So it seems that Germany is making slow haste to wean itself off Russian gas. And no wonder, because it's a near impossible task in the short or medium term. But I'd make a broader point that the other big lie that we tell ourselves is that sanctions are bringing Russia to its knees. It manifestly is not the case. Anybody can see that we're doing more harm to our own Western economies than we are to Russia's. The ruble bobs up and down, but the slide in the ruble appears to have been arrested. The Russian stock exchange is recovering. And there are absolutely no signs that the Russian authorities are changing their plans in response to the imposition of sanctions. And why should we ever believe this would be the case? Sanctions haven't worked with Syria, despite about 10 years of sanctions. They didn't work with Venezuela. They obviously haven't worked with North Korea. In fact, they backfired, visibly backfired. Iran, some claim, the other day a member of the House of Lords claimed to me when I was making this same point that Iran had bowed to sanctions. And I said, well, Iran did such a great deal for itself that the Americans subsequently reneged on it. So I don't think that proves that sanctions work. Anyway, the idea that our aim, our stated aim, is to cripple Russia. Wow, doesn't that remind anyone of the outcome of the 1914-18 World War? Look what a great idea it was to humble Germany in the aftermath of that conflict. I think we've lost our moorings. The whole Western approach is infantile, and that is why children tell themselves lies, and there are very few adults in the room.
Yes, yeah, I think the parallel that you brought up with the First World War, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, as they say, it rhymes. There's a lot of things that are rhyming right now with that time in the early 20th century. Although the Weimar hyperinflation seems to be kicking off on this side of the divide, unfortunately. So this is kind of like a major self-inflicted economic wound that seems to be going from bad to worse, Peter. I can't think of a worst possible policy direction that the West has taken on this, and it's like a unified policy. I mean, unified global responses, they don't always work. In fact, they can be disastrous. Didn't we learn that with COVID and lockdowns over the last 2 years? And here we are with another unified global response. And Russia's not suffering nearly the pain that I see a lot of people suffering in Europe, in the UK, in the US, because of record rises in fuel, energy, food shortages, all these goods and services embargoed commodities that Russia was providing to the world. I can't think of a worse possible policy decision, Peter. What's going on here?
And there's no sign of an exit strategy. We just push on blindly, ready to die to the last Ukrainian, goading Ukraine into more confrontation with Russia. And here's another lie we tell ourselves, that Russia is failing. I mean, to believe that the media is just one disaster after another. And yet, Russia now controls great swathes of Ukraine. It's poised to be in control of the whole of the Donbass, which incidentally is huge. It's at least the size of Britain. This is one of the factors about the conflict that everybody overlooks, the sheer size of Ukraine. It's no wonder that Russia hasn't made swifter progress when you just look at the distances involved. Russia is also poised to either blockade or take control of Odessa, which soon will be Ukraine's only outlet to the sea. And therefore, in fairly short order, Russia will probably be in a position to dictate peace terms. And yet, to believe the media, Russia is collapsing, Putin's going to be overthrown any day now. I mean, it's just infantile, the lies that we tell ourselves.
Yes, yes. And all of these sort of things that are popping up, the Bucha story and things like this, is kind of the call in the Western media, Peter, is that we must act, we must do something. I know that this sort of same treatment was done with Bashar al-Assad, Syrian president, putting him in the dock with the International Criminal Court. They seem to be doing the same with Vladimir Putin, trying to open up more emergency humanitarian corridors, still talk, although less, about a no-fly zone. But then we get to this issue of partitioning. And this isn't exactly the same as Syria in that certainly is not in Damascus's interest to partition his country. It's had to do sort of convenient arrangements to get through worse situations or lesser of two evil choices that Damascus had to make with the Kurdish and U.S. joint sort of, you know, taking of northeastern Syria. You've got Idlib provinces where the Al-Qaeda factions have held out, backed by, it seems, largely by Turkey. But in Ukraine, Peter, there's a potential for a partition. Let's be realistic. This is how things are shaping up right now. But in this case, what do you think what's left of Ukraine if we have this type of situation where it's divided along Russian-speaking and cultural lines, or historically Nova Russia, for instance, and you have Western Ukraine, historic Galicia, and you have this battle going on here. What do you think would be an acceptable arrangement in a sort of, I'm talking a few months down the line in peace negotiations on this, for the West, for NATO, yeah. for what's left of the Ukrainian government. Go ahead.
Let's be clear first. What's the worst possible outcome? And it's the one that the West appears to want at the moment. The creation of a line down the middle of Ukraine, where the West will be minutes away from direct conflict with Russia, a jagged line, ripe for accidents to happen, Russian soldiers on one side of it, and NATO soldiers on the other side. That's where the Western policy seems to be headed. They want to make they know that Ukraine can't drive the Russians back, but they want to stem Ukrainian losses, make sure that Ukraine remains a NATO protectorate, and therefore NATO will have perhaps what it's always hankered after, a border with Russia, which is ripe for exploitation and which would leave an extremely unstable situation. The optimal outcome would be for Ukraine to fulfill its natural function in life of being a buffer state. It would a peace agreement would establish a status of neutrality for Ukraine, which after all would only be the same as Finland or Austria. The demilitarization of Ukraine in the sense of NATO not being allowed to have bases and forces and training and all the rest. Geographically, there would need to be referenda in the affected territories in the Donbass that would probably decide either for independence or to rejoin Russia. And Crimea will inevitably remain with Russia. This would be a reasonable outcome, and it was on the table, as you have reported. Such an outcome was already on the table before a shot was fired. Mm-hmm. Zelensky could have settled for such a deal, and all these losses will have been in vain.
So the longer Zelensky When I say Zelensky, I'm talking about him plus whoever's behind him. I believe that's probably what the U.S. State Department and a few others. The longer they drag their heels on coming to some concessions or some kind of peace negotiations, is it conceivable, Peter, that the longer they stretch this process out, and the less territory is going to be practically preserved by what's left of the Ukrainian state?
Yeah, it's what the French call a peau de chagrin. That is a piece of leather which is wet, and then it shrinks painfully. Ukraine is wearing a peau de chagrin imposed on it by the West, a kind of corset which is growing tighter and tighter. The longer the fighting goes on, and the worse deal the Ukrainians will eventually secure.
Yeah, that should be the big fear for all the stakeholders involved. I'm wondering, how is this? I mean, how could they not? What I'm asking, Peter, is how can they not see it? How could the Western foreign policy A team not see this? Or is this a case of they don't mind that this is happening, that there is a broader, longer range plan at play here, and Ukraine is going to be cannon fodder for that?
Well, we've seen in Syria, it's wishful thinking. They mistake wishful thinking for serious analysis. I mean, British intelligence and the Foreign Office were reckoning early in the Syrian conflict that there was no way that Bashar al-Assad could survive. One of my successors was quoted as saying that Bashar will be gone by Christmas. Well, he may still be proved right, but he didn't say which Christmas. But, I mean, this is just so typical of the level of serious analysis, which doesn't take place. It's sheer wishful thinking and selection through the confirmation bias of pieces of evidence which fit the narrative that you want or the outcome that you want. We're seeing this constantly in Syria and Ukraine and lots more places. And there's another worrying thing. The analysis doesn't seem to go beyond tomorrow. What about the day after tomorrow? I mean, assuming the Western geniuses were right and they got their way and Russian forces were being routed, are they not concerned that Russia is a nuclear power? That its entire Russian doctrine does provide for the use of tactical nuclear weapons. I mean, if the Western strategy actually works as it's supposed to, force the Russians into a rout and cripple Russia, that these are our stated objectives, then are we not even taking into account the fact that Russia has tactical nuclear weapons? And once you start talking about that, you're quickly into strategic nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. It is scary that our leadership are clowns and infants.
Is it a case there, you know, at the ministerial level, when a crisis breaks out these days, you know, everybody's amped up, and I hear this a lot. We need to take action. Something must be done. We need to take action. And then someone raises their hand, Peter, one of the bright sparks raises their hand, say, we need to make this Putin's Afghanistan. Remember Afghanistan? We sent in the Stinger missiles and the Mujahideen drove those Soviets out. And yes. And then some consensus can form. Now, I'm telling you this, it's not a hypothetical. I've actually heard this exact reasoning in the mainstream British press with various officials. Is that a typical failed analysis, Peter?
It is, and it's so typical of the sheer callousness indifference to Ukrainian as well as Russian suffering, that the idea that the Ukrainians could be used as pawns so that NATO and America can stand tall, that they can have their country turned into a European Afghanistan, just so that Putin can't claim a victory. The cynicism, the callousness involved in that is an atrocity itself.
And that those were the words I remember when hostilities began, February 25th, I believe it was Boris Johnson, British Prime Minister, on the floor of the House of Commons said, Putin needs to fail and must seem to fail. And I was trying to work out what that means, Peter. Maybe you could help me explain. There is failure and then there's being seen to fail. It tried to get me into the mind of Boris Johnson there. What exactly does he mean?
Well, I think he often says the first thing that comes into his head or what sounds like it might appeal to the media on the day in question. I don't think he can have possibly thought it through, because if he got his way and that Putin was apparently on the point of failure and Russia was on the point of being crippled, then we would be into that scenario I described of Russia using its weapons of last resort. But that is what it would entail if Johnson was to get his stated objective. It's utterly unrealistic. It's not going to happen anyway, thank goodness. But if it did happen, it would be much worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think that's being thought through. The most extraordinary thing is we'll break it.
Sorry, finish on that. We have to bear in mind the British politics of this. And as you know, we got Partygate. Now, it's crystal clear that Boris Johnson has put Britain into a leading role in the warmongering on Ukraine. So that he can distract attention away from Partygate. There are still serious calls for him to be brought to account over that. So he's trying to channel Churchill and make it unthinkable that such an important war leader could be deposed over a trivial lie. Like Partygate, one would have to be very naive not to see that this was the main reason why Britain was putting itself in the lead. And by the way, it's pretty hypocritical for us to do so when we are less in the front line than other European countries, which may have borders with the affected territories, or which may be much more reliant on Russian gas than we are. It's typical British hypocrisy.
Yes, no, indeed. Well, I've got a few questions on the issue of sanctions, specifically with Europe as well. You're right, Peter. Britain and the U.S. being slightly remote from the theater, directly affected by the actual military theater, they seem to be the loudest and the most hawkish right the way through this. I think there's no surprise there why that's the case, why the more cautious
actually, I would say that Britain has been even more hawkish than some in the States. Some signs that, at least in the Pentagon, where war is more of a practical reality than it is in Congress or State Department, there are some cooler heads. But here in Britain, there are no cool heads. There are no cool heads.
No, they're going wild on this. Look, we're gonna take a break here with the station with TNT Today's News Talk. I'm your host Patrick Henningsen. I'm talking to former ambassador, British Ambassador Peter Ford. We're breaking down the situation in Ukraine, and we're gonna go even further just after these messages with TNT. Stick around. We'll be right back.
When it comes to making plans, you are the best. What about those round trips that you plan in advance, which are perfect on your way there and perfect on your way back? Or those meetings with friends for which you make a group chat 3 months before so that nobody or anything is missing? Or your daughter's first birthday party? You planned it with such dedication that instead of the first, it felt like our quinces. The same way you plan each detail for those moments. Start planning to protect you and your loved ones from a natural disaster. Sign up for local weather and emergency alerts. Prepare an emergency kit and make a family communications plan. Protecting your family is the best plan you can make. Get started at ready.gov/plan.
Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
I will be right by your side.
Women can have it all, including heart attacks. But symptoms like jaw pain, nausea, unusual fatigue, dizziness, and backache are often different and more subtle than for a man. The fact is, heart disease is the number one killer of women. Know the signs. Learn more at getheartchecked.org. From Women's Heart Alliance, in partnership with Women Heart.
When you remember this year's holiday, will you think of the waves gently lapping on the shore? The sun setting over rolling hills? Or sat, bored out of your mind with a flat tire, waiting for a recovery truck? 1 in 5 motorway breakdowns are caused by tire problems. Before you set off, check your tire pressure. Highways England.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to TNT Today's News Talk. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. We are on the line right now with the former British ambassador for Syria and Bahrain. His name is Peter Ford. And we're really just kind of trying to pry open what are really some of the really important aspects of the Ukraine situation. But we're going to cast our net even broader here. You know, before the break, Peter, you brought up a couple of interesting points with regards to British foreign policy. I mean, the public is being asked. We're not officially at war. Okay, NATO's not officially at war, we're told. We're not directly at war. But yet we sort of are, Peter, you know, because economic war has been declared. The information war has been declared. Russian broadcasters have been pulled off the air. They're sanctioning. First time ever, sanctioning RT, all its employees, anybody that does business with RT, any employees, I would imagine contractors could be sanctioned for having any relationship with RT. This just came last week. Pretty shocking stuff. But not only that, economically, people are asking to invest in this conflict. In other words, tighten your belt. Whatever economic hardship is coming because of these sanctions, these global sanctions that are in place, that people, they've asked the public to invest on different levels. The government's also trafficking weapons into the war zone. Okay, so there's a big commitment financially and militarily there, even though it's not, quote, over the table. So my question, Peter, is, you know, are we at war? And what we're being asked to invest economically in this conflict. This is unprecedented, Peter.
It is. We're in a state of hybrid war. This concept has been coming to the fore in strategic thinking in the last 10, 20 years. And we have the definition of it here. As you pointed out, there's what they now call the battle space of information, the battle space of information, which is based primarily on trying to persuade our own public of certain things, to maintain enthusiasm for the hybrid war, and persuade us that the sacrifices that we're making in the economic war, the sanctions are worth it, that it's for the greater good, a phrase we constantly heard in over the last 2 years in the context of lockdowns and all the rest of the COVID panoply of restrictions, that they were for the greater good, when the evidence is now coming out almost by the day that they weren't for anybody's good except some vested interests. So yeah, we are in a virtual state of war, and it's extremely dangerous. I mean, people forget history, not just the reparations issue with Germany at the end of the 1418 war, which is where we say we want to be with Russia. Not just that, but the question of how did Japan get to attack the United States. I mean, how many people remember that it was because of sanctions?
That's right.
Japan was a subject of a blockade, an oil blockade, by the US and the UK to such a point that they calculated that their best bet was to strike a preemptive blow at the US, and particularly the US Navy. Everybody just assumes that the Japanese one fine day thought, oh, wouldn't it be a great idea to bring the U.S. into the war? Let's go bomb Honolulu. No, their backs were to the wall. They'd behaved pretty abominably in China and elsewhere in Asia. But the fact remains that actions have consequences. Mm. And if you're going to blockade a country, you'd better be ready for their retaliation. We've yet to see how the Russian retaliation might manifest itself, but it's already pretty bad before we even reach that point, the way the economic sanctions are backfiring on us in an energy situation that was already extremely tight because of our lunacies on COVID and on climatism. And we're compounding this now. And it can only get worse.
Yeah, that's.
I think we may well be seeing civil unrest over this issue before very long. And so the combination of war and civil unrest make for a very toxic combination.
No, you just laid out the trifecta there, the holy trinity of crisis, Peter. You mentioned COVID, the COVID crisis, the climate crisis, and the Russian crisis, and you put those three things together, and all the policies that are attached to those different crises, and I see that is the foundation of a lot of the economic pressure, a lot of the problems with the financial system, with the energy markets, with the price of heating and gas and electric, the food shortages, the fertilizer shortages. All of these things are connected to that trifecta, Peter. All of those have one thing in common, a unified response, a global response. That's 0-3 in baseball. And Peter, in America, we call that you've struck out. Three strikes. Mm-hmm. At what point are we going to look at this and say, maybe unified, global, centralized policy responses might not be a good idea?
Exactly. And there's the irony that our own actions are in fact making a global response to just about anything less likely. I mean, look at how China and India have refused to side with what we laughingly call the international community, by which, of course, we mean the white Anglosphere plus a few other folks that we control, white. The world is dividing up more and more into two camps. I mean, George Bush famously said, you're either with us or against us. Well, that seems to be the attitude towards places like India. Our magnificent super diplomat Liz Truss went to India the other day, did she not, to berate the Indians for their failure to support us on Ukraine. And what happened? She was sent away with a flea in her ear. The Indians won't be dictated to, and nor will the Chinese. So they're alone. You have more than half the population of the world, which is not with us. And this also manifests itself at the UN when there was a vote to condemn Russia. The countries representing more than half of humanity would not go along with it. Half of African countries, although many of them were being bribed and strong-armed, still half of Africa would not go along with it. And yet we this is what, another of the lies that we tell ourselves, that the international community, as though that meant the whole world, was saw it our way. They don't.
And what is there any other is there another foreign policy or another geopolitical worldview? Take Britain for instance, because it occupies a very unique position historically, geographically, in relation to Europe and globally, with its history, its legacy of the British Empire, an amazing trade network. Global trade network, cultural as well. Sterling used to be the world's reserve currency effectively before the dollar was. But it seems to me, what is the policy now? Is Britain pursuing a bifurcated global order or economy where the United States is its trading pairing partner? Is that the only option available? Certainly Britain's a free agent. It should be able to be prosperous by linking in with Asia as well as anywhere else in the world for that matter. What is this, a lack of vision, or is this the vision, Peter?
I'm tempted to say it's a lack of vision. Our policies are decided on the hoof, depending on focus groups and what tactical need Boris Johnson has on the day in question. But to the extent that there was a British vision, then I regret to say that it would be absolutely dreadful. It would involve constant conflict with Russia. Our vision seems to be to recreate the Manichaean world of the Cold War. And it's rather interesting that the very good drama Ipcrest's File is playing to huge audiences on TV at the moment. We're nostalgic for the Cold War, and our obsession with spies is a manifestation of this illusion that somehow we are better than others, cleverer than others, that we may not have a huge empire anymore, but we can still control others through our intelligence services. It's infantile, regressive, deranged. And here we are wondering if Putin is deranged. I think we should look in the mirror.
Yes. Well, look, my theory on this, Peter, is that, you know, when you have the entrenched intelligentsia at the top of the culture, let's say the US and the UK, the foreign policy establishment, the political elites, you know, when the bipolar world order, in other words, when the Cold War, for instance, I mean, there was an elegant simplicity to it, or a predictability to it, that I think it's attractive. And you talked about the spy culture, and, you know, looking back in endearment with that type of those narratives, those characters, those histories, those plots. It's just easier, isn't it? The bipolar, the binary, the Manichaean, as you said, you know, it's it it doesn't, it's not, it's more predictable. In other words, a multipolar world order where you got to be ready to deal and maybe make concessions, maybe, you know, do different sort of deals. That's a little bit more complicated. And how you fit into that politically, into that world, you might need to actually put yourself into the shoes of someone else, God, heaven forbid. Do you think there's a bit of that at the entrenched level, the decision-making level, the elite level?
Absolutely, Patrick. And this manifests itself in smaller ways. For example, our obsession with monarchy. And it's just so typical of our vision that we think we can send a royal to the Caribbean and let them prance around like viceroys. And therefore, there not to be some comeback from the natives. That just seems to encapsulate everything about our regressive attitudes. We're still living in the past. We're still living on the glories of the empire and the Second World War. We've never gotten over it. Historians may argue that the Brexit debate also forced us into further regression, bringing out old stereotypes. We're in a pretty confused state, as shown by the debate over the future of the monarchy.
No, definitely. That's a domestic debate it does pop up periodically, doesn't it, Peter? The monarchy debate, and then it kind of gets suppressed.
Well, it's also a manifestation of our inherent militarism. I mean, why do we just take it for granted that the monarch is the head of the armed forces, and that the monarch's offspring should all wear uniform at some point? The identification of the military of royalty with militarism says everything about our vision.
Yeah, I do notice that. I know you pointed it out in the past, specifically, you know, when the royal weddings, even if they're not, normally they would have to be serving, right? To don the military uniform during a ceremony like that, but they're wearing it anyway these days as a kind of a costume of sorts, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And the choice, people say they want a modern monarchy. Well, the choice is between either a militarized monarchy or the wokery of the Californian exile, Harry.
Oh, yes. Yeah, he's doing good. They signed with Spotify as well, coincidentally, as well as Joe Rogan. They got paid a lot of money, but they haven't produced any podcasts. That was very strange. They're just throwing money at them, Peter. Everybody's lining up to throw money at those two for some reason.
Well, one set of royalty, the British, meets another, Hollywood.
Yes. Both damaged brands, I would probably argue, as well. But we just got a minute left, Peter. Just your final thoughts on you know, where the war, the Ukraine situation is now, just before we wrap up. But go ahead. We've got about a minute.
I just wish people would focus more on the security of Britain. This seems to be entirely missing from the public debate in this country, how it affects or might affect our security in our towns and cities, and how it's already affecting us economically, and our affecting our social cohesiveness, given the authoritarian attitude the war is spawning, and the censorship. I think we should be more focused on the dangers of continuing conflict on this country. Let the Ukrainians look after themselves.
No, definitely. Well, this conversation is going to get even more intense, certainly going into the next few months, where this economic situation is going to be heading. I've got an idea of where it's heading. It's not particularly positive at the moment. So we're hoping that some sane heads emerge and they do a handbrake turn on where we're at right now. But thank you very much, Peter Ford, for joining us today on TNT.
Thank you, Patrick. Been a pleasure.
No, it's a pleasure. Is all ours. Pleasure is all ours. We're going to break with the network and we'll be back on the other side. We're going to have a chat with another guest, Sir Julian Rose from Poland. He's going to be joining us on the other side. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. You're listening to TNT, today's news talk. We'll be right back.